Well, welcome back, students, to the Western Theological Tradition. This is our Origins Week. We're considering this week various theories of the origins of basically the animals and mankind and what's called the origin of species. And I'm doing this, as I told you before, to kind of prepare the way for the Bible. We're going to start in the book of Genesis next week. And for some of you, this is the first time that you've ever considered a biblical book. And if you consider the book of Genesis, many people have objections to that book on the basis of various theories of origin. And so I would like to give the book a fair hearing, kind of like allowing you to have a fresh start. And one of the ways to do that is to take the origins issue up front, look at the various theories, of which the reigning theory is now Darwinian or neo-Darwinian evolution, and say, okay, how should we consider that? Are there ways of looking at it that would be compatible with the Bible? And if so, what might they be? And so today's topic is theistic evolution. Many Christians have adopted this as the solution of their view of science and religion, and basically not holding to maybe perhaps a fact-value split. They want to have a unified field of knowledge, as Francis Schaeffer says. They would like to have some view of the universe that is compatible with their view of the Bible. They want to hold to both. For many, this has been the option that they have chosen. So, in order to do this, we need to define again what evolution is, and then what theistic evolution is. And those of you who have taken logic, you understand that a definition is a genus and a species. That's kind of ironic given our topic today. And so the genus, the larger category, is evolution, which is descent with modification. That's Darwin's phrase. Species changing into other species, into new species. And so kind of indefinite chain of speciation, you might say. This is the typical evolutionary theory. And so that's evolution. Anything that gets you from one species ultimately to another in this large, no longer called tree of life, but bush of life, just branching out, whatever enables the species to survive or adapt in a new environment. Whatever slight modifications then enabled the population to survive, those get perpetuated to offspring, and it truly becomes the survival of the fittest. That, of course, is a Darwinian evolutionary theory. Now, what is theistic evolution then? That would be, as theism is God, that would be God then using evolution to bring about the various animals that we see. Now, there's two kinds, I think, of Darwinian, say, theistic evolution. And one of it is like God maybe set up all the laws. Darwin was not happy with thinking it's by chance. He viewed natural selection on the category of a law. And so God would have set up this law through natural selection that would produce ultimately all the animals then that we see. And so that I might call as deistic evolution. Like God set the law up, he wound the clock up, and it's been going all along kind of on its own. Another view of this might be that God has been integral to the process all along in a subtle, sudden, hidden kind of way, and maybe has inserted himself at various times, say at the beginning of life, or with mankind and giving spirit or soul or mind, personality, so that at various stages where there seemed to be a qualitative development, God then inserted something new, as well as has sustained and governed the process providentially. That, to me, might be more rightly called a theistic evolution. But either way, there's a God involved, and the God of the Bible, in this case, we're looking at how Christians would adapt an evolutionary theory to their faith, and so it would be the God of the Bible using evolution to bring it about. And when it comes to the book of Genesis, there's various ways of interpreting that opening chapter to fit such a scheme. Okay, How this comes about is mainly by natural selection, though there are other means, sexual selection being one. The beautiful male gets the female more often, and then those traits would be carried on to offspring and would dominate. The evidences or the witnesses were given to you in the reading for today, and I trust that each of you has done your reading for today. It was an article by Jonathan Wells, who is, I believe, a Berkeley-trained embryologist, and then got a PhD also on his work of Charles Hodge's critique of Charles Darwin's theory. This would be late 1800s. And you can see from the article that he's very familiar with The Origin of Species. And having read The Origin of Species, I can testify that it is true. I think there's about 145 references to creation in that large, or what Darwin called the long argument. And as we said last time, almost every major section ends with, on the theory of creation, these things are inexplicable. And so there's a kind of like, this is the creator, and then this view of creator does not match the data that we see in adaptation, and therefore we need a new theory. So I think that Wells's main point is valid, even if here or there, perhaps, and probably so, he could be critiqued, especially with regard to genetics, because that field continues to develop in an indefinite way, just with no end in sight, it would seem like. But here's the records. I'm going to call these to the witness stands. On the one hand, we have the record from the past. We have the fossil record predominantly. Preserved in rock, these are the creatures that have been there in the past. And that would be the field of paleontology. That would be closely related, obviously, on the one hand, to geology and the geological column, and to them marking the strata of sedimentary rock, as well, on the other hand, to biology and to the study of living creatures as we find them today, and the processes that occur within the cell and in the ecosphere and all that biological interactions. We also see that there's a geographic distribution of animals and of plants in the present day. This is a modern phenomenon that has implications about the past. And so if you were to then look at, as Darwin does, there's these alpine plants over here on this mountain range, very similar to these alpine plants on another continent. The question is, how did they both get there? And he would say the old theory was that God, being the perfect God, designed this little alpine plant for that specific location, and that little alpine plant for that specific location, and he crafted in his wisdom and goodness the specific, very precise species for each locale. And so that theory of kind of the perfect God, being the straw God he knocks down, if that's not true, then we have to come up with another explanation. His explanation involved the Ice Age and how basically the meteorological conditions of places changed, and as it changed, then what used to be down in the floor of the valleys where they were all together could move up, say, the mountains to the alpine regions. I think it was something like that as the earth, say, warmed up and the cool regions then became the high regions. Present processes would be, say, genetics, mammoth field, homology. Now, that's borrowing a term from Charles Darwin. Homology is when this structure, say, the wing of a bat and the fin of a whale could be very similar, and they could then be traced back to a common ancestor. That's a homology. An analogy is when distinct species put in similar environments then evolve similarly, so that the result obviously is then similar between the two species, but it doesn't indicate a hereditary same ancestor, same hereditary background. That's an analogy. Well, homology is now not as much anatomical homology, dealing with bone structures and things. but has now shifted, I'm told, to more molecular homology and the similarities on that level. And the last process is just adaptation. You know, the bacteria that morphs and becomes, you know, we had a tuberculosis, vaccine, not a vaccine, but a treatment, and we were getting rid of it here, and all of a sudden a more virulent strain, you know, evolves that is resistant to our current antibiotics and then comes back with a vengeance. To survive, then the bacteria has outwitted us and has gone around the end and come back in a different form. That kind of adaptation among the species then can be watched. And of course, with small little one-cell creatures, this can be watched on a large scale because generations come and go pretty quickly, contrary to, say, elephants or especially sea turtles. Okay, do you understand the witnesses idea? And you've read on now that article that bring them to the stand and we can then assess it. Okay. What I want to do today then is to look at some questions that I personally have had on this issue and then give a biblical assessment and kind of look at it from what the text in the Bible is saying and what things we might look at on a more principled level. As many of you know, my background is in mechanical engineering and mathematics, and then I studied, you know, scripture and theology and history. So when I was in my bachelor's degree, there wasn't anything alive, in my training. Mechanical engineers deal with the tensile strength of steel or etching materials and designing machines, maybe even some electricity or some chemicals, but nothing close to a living organism. So this is not my field. But as a Christian, it is something that touches on the nature of God and His Word, what it means to be Creator, and so I desire to have a view. And I'm going to share with you the questions that I've had. I'm not coming to you as an authority in biology. I'm coming to you as a Christian, sharing with you the things that I've learned to this point, the things that have shaped my own way of thinking, the questions that I've had. And I trust that they will be helpful for you and you as an individual. As the Bible says, let every man be fully convinced in his own mind. The faith that you have as your own before God. I trust that as an individual, this will be of some aid to you in establishing or strengthening your own personal faith as you think through these issues. So number one, is interspecies evolution the same thing as interspecies evolution? Now these terms are ones that I coined. I don't know that I've read them anywhere, but intra, like intramural sports, is when things occur within an organization. So we have teams on campus playing other teams on campus. Inter, like the interstate system, going from state to different state, or intercollegiate basketball, teams playing from one campus to a different campus, that is your classical large-scale Darwinian evolution, species then creating new species. Some have called this the difference between microevolution and macroevolution. Is this the same process? I remember reading Philip Johnson's book, Darwin on Trial, where he questioned whether it is actually the same. Obviously, there are similarities. There's an adaptation. But is it the same process? Are we applying equivocating using the same term for something that should actually be distinguished? Now, you might say playing basketball is playing basketball. What does it matter if it's intramural basketball or intercollegiate basketball? Well, in one sense, it doesn't matter. But in another sense, it does. For the personal player, does he have the ability to play at intercollegiate level? Most students do not, and they play ball then on campus with other teams on campus. It's similar to that. Does this process of adaptation have the ability to go from interspecies evolution to interspecies evolution? It appears to me that may be an assumption. Some may be offended with me even bringing this up. I think there are those that would take offense. Evolution is evolution. It's an established fact. You can try to split it up as micro, macro, but that's largely due to the fact that you haven't had time enough to see it happen. It happens over eons, and you only look at years. And so the fact established on the small scale level, the micro level, then implies it happens on the macro level, and you are basically, quibbling to show such distinctions. Well, personally, I think there is such a distinction, that there should be questioned. Are the two really the same? Similar to this would be on the molecular level, how much genetic overlap is there, or correlation is there between if this species came from this species, knowing as we do that this ultimately is driven by DNA, perhaps I've heard some say even RNA, kind of reversing the order of it. At any rate, it occurs on the molecular level. Is there a correspondence between what we see externally and what happens internally? Now, I'm not talking about the kind of statistical correspondence that might say 90% of what is on the DNA here is on the DNA there. That might be not enough for us to tell there's a correspondence between the two compared to other correspondences. Perhaps all creatures have 90% of their DNA the same. We would want to look at the specific areas where one is distinguished from another, and is there a correlation? I've read some things that would question that there is. And so I would like to know, to what degree is there a correlation on a broad scale and not on a small scale? I hope that makes sense. Number two. With regard to genetic mutations, and let's just look at that, are there limits? And by that I mean, if it's going from intra-species to inter, is the genetic mutations sufficient to account for such large-scale change? So as there's slight variations and sporadic changes on the DNA level, where most of them maybe are degenerative, are there enough of the ones that are, say, positive contributing that would then develop into the large-scale changes that ultimately are needed on the Darwinian evolutionary model? Question related to that would be, is new information given, or is it simply information taken away where this or that is damaged? Similarly to my eyesight or my hearing, which could be taken away, but a sixth or seventh or eighth sense is not typically given to the human being. Is there more fitness possible? When you look at breeding, which is artificial selection, domestic breeding, normally when you get more and more specific and start seeing greater and greater differences in the species itself, which might point to an evolutionary development, normally as you get towards the fringe of the species, it becomes less and less healthy. Versus if you stay at the core, kind of the muttness, when you look at dogs, the mutt, the cross between a, that they're more healthy at the core, where there's a lot of kind of like crossbreeding going on with the various kinds. I remember I had a dairy farmer friend of mine that took his horse trailer several states away to New Hampshire to get some Jersey cows from a herd up there in order to freshen up his own herd. It's that kind of a thing. If you get too inbred, you become unhealthy. I've even seen that happen on the level of those that are kind of clannish on the human level, where too many cousins are marrying too many cousins and muscular dystrophy happens, and I'm seeing 20-year-old somethings being wheeled out for recreation. They're already in wheelchairs. There's been too much inbreeding going on, from what I was told. So if that's the case, to go from this species into new species and kind of go towards the border, it would appear like we're becoming less fit and it's going to be less likely. And on the genetic level, if most of them are degenerative, is there enough that would say be new information, or is it even new information possible? Third, with regard to the fossils, Darwin was very clear on Origin of Species that if my theory is true, there should be a lot, and he used the word many, there should be many extinct forms that would be discovered. This is the part of the fossil record I hadn't thought about much. I had always heard about the missing links, you know, and so my imagination went to, well, here's a creature here, and here's one over there, and so somebody should have died midway, you know, as it started morphing from this into that, and then there it is in the rocks. You know, we kind of see it caught in mid-action as such. I used to think about that. Those are the transitional forms, but there should also be extinct forms. This is a trial and error theory. There should be developments that didn't work. They didn't survive. And so where are they? Where are the transitional forms? Where are the extinct forms? I had a student a couple years back, you know, sent me some references saying there's plenty of transitional forms. And so I need to look at them more carefully, whether they are truly transitional from this kind, you might say, large body of, say, horses to something else, or whether what we're finding in there is, say, some weird kind of forms of like mules, something in between a horse and a donkey or something in between this or that. I'd like to know then on to what extent those fossils would be truly transitional from one large subgroup of species to another, so that it would be clear this is definitely a transitional form. Fourth, with regard to the rocks, it was known to Darwin, it's been known for a long time, that the Cambrian rocks are special. It's within the Cambrian level or layer of rocks that all of a sudden you have a variety of fossils show up. And they're not previously in the rocks. In the 1970s, Stephen Jay Gould and Niles Eldridge published a book on this phenomenon, the Cambrian explosion. And I learned about it through Philip Johnson's book, as he made large, extensive use of it, that basically it's an explosion. All the phyla are represented in that one layer of rock, and they're previously in the older layer of rocks, not present. Now, there's been various theories about that. There are life forms in the previous layer of rocks. Some of the theories are, you know, is that maybe they were all soft-bodied and they couldn't leave fossils behind. That seems to be it would seem to be quite a coincidence if all the phyla had only soft bodies before that. But this is what's called a saltation, or at least it looks like a saltation, from the Latin word jump. Saltations make evolutionary theorists jumpy, not to be too punny about that, but a saltation looks very much like a creation, to have all of a sudden things show up. Well, the authors then went on to say it's not only a saltation, or appears to be like a saltation with all the phyla represented, there's also stasis. That if you go into the layers beyond that, which would be subsequent in time, that all the phyla's lack a directional change. In other words, they basically stay the same. They keep their basic forms. There's not the kind of trajectory that evolution would predict. Now, that didn't shake these men from believing in evolution. They just came up with another theory, a theory that they called punctuated equilibrium. The equilibrium is the stasis. These are basically stable forms of life. Punctuated means that evolution happened in brief spans of time, then bracketed by large time periods of no change or little change. Now, when I say the word brief, we're talking relatively brief, right? We're not talking about, you know, a couple days. This is compared to eons of time. But in the scale of the rocks, this would be relatively brief. And so a population became isolated, which we often see islands breed these kind of radical changes. And there's a lot more weird forms on island or separated populations. And so maybe they over here in this valley or this mountain or over in this island, they then changed over there and then re-entered back to the larger community, larger continent, and then died. And now we don't see in the fossils any change. They appear to be new, you know, regular phyla, but it changed off stage. It's kind of, to me, it reminds me, it's like the Clark Kent theory of evolution. You know, he's the newspaper man by day, but then he goes over here to his telephone booth where you can't see, and he comes out as Superman. It's that kind of a way of looking at evolution, if I can kind of paint it in broad strokes, kind of cartoonish-like. So, this theory, I know that Johnson had questions about it, because it would seem then to be question begging. Where is the evidence then for that? More assuming evolution is a fact and then explaining the lack of evidence in this way. But it's a question. The Cambrian explosion, been known, as I said, for a long time. Well, here's some larger questions. These are more philosophical, but they move us to the largest and broadest level. Number one, has there always been matter and energy? In an evolutionary view, if there's no creator, now theistic evolution, maybe you could have a point where there was nothing and now there's something, and like with the deism, sets in motion these various laws. But in a strict evolutionary setting, there has to be something. For there to be something. I just cannot adapt the idea that you can move from nothing to something. Even if it's like the point that started the Big Bang, there still has to be a point, you know, that where everything is compressed into that one. You have to start with something. And even then, philosophically, I heard, if it was all in that one point, what's the something that caused that point to then burst and change? What's the trigger? You can't just start from nothing and get everything. So, I think Aristotle, being a Greek philosopher, even with his prime mover, his first cause and all that, still posited eternal matter. Number two, how about the laws of thermodynamics, especially the second? The first law is the conservation of mass and energy. The second law, the one pertinent to this, is the accumulation of entropy for any process. So any process accumulates disorder, which is then quantified as entropy in thermodynamics. This is the course that in my program of mechanical engineering was kind of like the weeding out course. A junior level course that was difficult, and I remember, you know, it's kind of like organic chemistry for the pre-med track. Our textbook in North Dakota State University, our textbook in the preface said that the second law is a witness to creation. There's a couple ways that it does that. I mean, I think one is on a philosophical level. You can't always be going downhill. There has to be some point that it degenerates from order to disorder. I think you have an infinite regress otherwise. And again, then you're back to the eternal matter. On the other hand, and more pertinent to this question right here, it would seem like when we go out into nature, what we find is that naturally things move from order to disorder. Whereas evolution appears to move the other way, to go from less complex to more complex, or from less order to more order. What enables, then, evolution on a large scale sustained over eons of time to apparently buck the second law of thermodynamics that is testified to again and again and again and again as we go out chemically into the world and study? mass and energy. Well, the physics book that I use at the high school I teach, Spring Branch Academy, is the same book that was used at the college for a while for this kind of like general physics class to introduce all students to physics. Art Hobson is the author, and he says that basically the second law of thermodynamics would not need to be violated by something like evolution if the larger system has an increase in entropy, even though the isolated portion of that system, i.e. the Earth, is an exception to that large-scale increase of entropy. And so, and theoretically that would be true, right? Your system as a whole could increase in disorder, while one portion of that system would be an exception to that increase in disorder. Well, as I thought about it, and, you know, it caused me to pause. I thought about it. I said, well, then, a couple questions. What makes the Earth an exception to that larger rule? Because that in itself would be exceptional. You know, there must be some reason why it would be an exception. And some people have talked about the Earth being the privileged planet, and some, you know, what would make it the exception? But even so, I'm on the Earth. And when I go out into the world to build my bridges or build my cars or cook my food or do whatever, every process I touch builds entropy. So I don't see it in the present day, the Earth being an exception. Why then should I regard evolution as an exception in an environment where there isn't an exception to be found for the second law of thermodynamics? Well, that also is a question. Third question related is, and these are huge questions, where's the origin of life? How did life come about? Life itself is a marvelous mystery to me. I remember being at a gas station in Wisconsin on my way back home to visit family for Christmas break, Christmas vacation, and I saw a postcard with an owl flying. For whatever reason, it struck me at that moment, the owl is alive. It could fly to the left or to the right. It makes its, it determines its own course. It has freedom. It has life. It's alive. I just thought, what a marvelous thing that is, that God can give life to creatures. It's more than just a pile of chemicals together. There's a mysterious element about it that has that sense of freedom with it. And so, where did that come from? The primordial soup, the conditions being ripe for amino acids to form, for the first life to emerge. That is a wonderful story. What causes that? What brings that about? I mean, that's a marvel. It's called abiogenesis among the scientists. It needs to be explained. Where is the origin of life? Finally, the last is, how about the origin of mind? This question alone caused an atheistic philosopher named Thomas Nagel to give up on Darwinian evolution. It didn't cause him to give up on his atheism. He still held to his atheism, but in his book Mind and Cosmos, which has been offered as a seminar at the college in the past, studied, in that book he gives up apparently on evolution or Darwinian evolution and says, essentially, I still believe in evolution, but it can't be this way because that way does not account for the origin of mind. It was in a review in the Claremont Review of Books that I came across the summary of that argument. Francis Schaeffer also talks about this on page 112 of Escape from Reason. He says, if the intrinsically personal origin of the universe is rejected, by intrinsically personal, he's talking about the infinite personal God of Christianity. If that view is rejected, what alternative outlook can anyone have? It must be said emphatically that there is no final answer except that man is a product of the impersonal plus time plus chance. No one has ever succeeded in finding personality on that basis. though many, like the late Teilhard de Chardin, have tried, it cannot be done. Now that's a bold statement, isn't it? It almost challenges us to say, oh yeah, well I'll come up with a way. I'll think how it might be done. And there's a good portion of science that needs to challenge assumptions, right? Because our lack of imagination has often kept us back from both discovery and technological advancements. But on something like this, looked at philosophically, there's a qualitative jump from impersonal to personal, just as there is from non-life to life, that should make us pause. And it should make us pause, give pause for this reason. All four of these larger questions have this in common. A greater is coming from a lesser. And that is not intuitive. That's not the way I look at the world. I do not expect greater things, greater results to happen from lesser causes. So here I go from nothing to something, or I go from disorder to order, or I go from non-life to life, or I go from impersonal to personal. In all four of those areas, I have a greater coming from a lesser, and that is not intuitive to me. That must be explained to me. And I think the burden of proof is on that side of things, not on me having to prove otherwise. Because this is the way I experience life, and if the present is key to the past, and the processes that I experience here are key to the past, then these are questions that, in my opinion, would need to be answered. Well, let's look at it from the Bible and give a biblical assessment of some of these things. I want to start by saying we need to exercise caution when it comes to extrapolation. Some of you are in the math and science world, and you understand that when you have a bunch of data points, you can graph them. And then because you empirically gather them, they're not going to be nice and in a row. They're going to be scattered to some degree. But if they come from a natural process, which means it can be mathematically modeled, you know that behind it is some kind of a curve or function. And so you can use retrogression or something to give a best fit curve to your data points. That curve has a lot of authority, or at least, you know, there's a lot of greater certainty in between the points, interpolating. But there's not as much authority outside of the points. If you extend those lines and curves beyond your data points where you studied, you are involving risk. You're assuming that conditions didn't change out there and we can extrapolate to those points. Businesses do it when they forecast we're going to make such and such money this year because we've been tracking the last 3 to 5 years and we can see that we're moving in this direction. But that's dangerous, isn't it? There's always risk involved with extrapolating from the present into the future. The same risk is involved from extrapolating from the present into the past. In the little graph, I have you over on the right. There you are, looking back to the past, down the corridors of time, eons of time, towards the beginnings of everything. And according to the Bible, the things that you would see that would block your vision from the world that existed previously are 3 large obstacles that I've alliterated with the letter F to help you remember them. 3 large events that caution you from extrapolating from the world you know here into the past as if things have always been happening the same as they're happening today. First, fiat. That's not an Italian car. I'm borrowing this word, though, from the Italian word for an absolute command. Vayomer Elohim, Yahi Or, Vahi Or. You know, then God said, let there be light, and there was light. I can't do that. I can't just command something to happen. But God did, according to the Bible. Now, let's just say that he did that with this marker. OK, Okay, in class I use a marker, and so, you know, so think of me holding up a marker right now. I say, now, if this marker came about by me saying, let there be marker, right? And there is marker. Is there any way that you could take this into the laboratory and ascertain that it came from nothing? By all accounts, you would look at it and say, it looks, it has molecular structure, you know, it has order, and so there's no indications here that it came from nothing. And that Bible is clear in acknowledging there's no way that empirically you and I can kind of infer to that point. That's why the New Testament just flat out says it's by faith that we understand that the worlds were prepared by the Word of God, so that what is seen was not made out of things that were seen. And so God made the world by His Word. That which is seen came from things that was unseen. How do we know that? Only by faith. He had to tell us. And then we're back to a witness again. In this point, the witness is God, or the witness is personal. Number two, there's also then, according to the Bible, a fall. At the fall, a moral choice of disobedience was made, and the result was God bent the world. I'm borrowing this from Ecclesiastes 7, where it says that who can straighten what God has bent? A more typical word is God cursed the world. He cursed creation. He made the processes become burdensome. By the sweat of your brow you shall earn your bread, right? And the ground which is cursed shall produce thorns and thistles, and to dust you shall return. That curse, which Romans 8 says applies to all creation, that curse then, I believe, is the place of entropy being imposed upon the universe, where now things dissipate, energy dissipates, and you can't have a perfect motion machine, and there's always disorder being created in anything that we do. And maybe I'm wrong on that in correlating the two, but according to the Bible, death is the result of the fall. Now this is very important for us, because many times the straw God argument would say, if there is a God who is powerful and good, then why would he, and then fill in the blank, why would he allow this animal to eat this other animal, or this disease to take out this population, or this or that or the other thing? In other words, why are there thorns and thistles in the world if there's such a good God and a perfect God? Well, that's assuming that there's no moral punishment, moral disobedience, and then the resulting punishment put upon the world, that there's no curse. But according to a Christian worldview, it's actually what you would expect. Waste, death, brokenness, to look out into the world and find a mess. Doesn't surprise any Christian, as if now I shouldn't believe in a God, because that's the way I see the world. In fact, it's what a Christian would expect. I think it's even possible that physiological changes occurred. Both carnivorous and predatory elements were given to the animals, as well as protective features were given to combat that predatorial thing. It's like the world became red in tooth and claw, that kind of a thing at that point. It doesn't mean that design is hidden. John Calvin, a reformer from the 1500s, spoke about our world being a ruined temple. Like going to the Parthenon, which I think was blown up because the Turks stored some gunpowder there at some point. But, you know, and seeing the columns broken down, and yet you can look at the shapes and go, this was once beautiful. It still evidences its original design, despite the fact that it's broken. I think we can still see design, but just because we don't see perfect design, we see waste and death. That also can be accounted by both fiat and fall. And then finally, there's flood. You're going to read about it in Genesis next week, how Noah had the big box, the Hebrew word for ark, and had the animals in there, and the world basically started over. God covered everything back up with water and started fresh with a new Adam named Noah, a new man, and told him then to be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth. The same thing that he told Adam earlier. This flood, which I wouldn't be surprised corresponds to what the geologists often talk about, the ice age. This flood is a catastrophe. And the Bible's view of geology and the world has at least one mammoth catastrophe. If Charles Lyell's view that influenced Darwin so heavily is correct, of a uniformitarian history geologically, then there couldn't have been a flood, because all you have then is slight changes over eons of time. And the processes we see today, present being key to the past, just need to be stretched over time, very similar to Darwin's evolution of slight successive modifications or variations then changing the species. If that's the case, it's easy to do a little math and go, the Colorado River takes only so much dirt away a year, and so given, you know, changes in, you know, ups and downs, variations and fluctuations in waterfall, here's the average, and on average it takes so much dirt away a year. You can do a little math based on the volume of the Grand Canyon and go, it takes millions of years to take away this much dirt. It appears to be self-evident. Unless a mammoth worldwide flood occurs in which you have gully washers on large scale happening. In which case, a Grand Canyon could be removed within a matter of a year or something, just with the whole world covering the mountains and then the waters receding and all that the Bible says. So the whole picture changes, and it would be because that involved a meteorological change of some sort where it rains 40 days and 40 nights and there doesn't appear to be rain before that time, and the foundations of the earth were broken up, and maybe that's tectonic changes in the continents. I don't know for sure. There's various ways to explain it. Like Job and his friends, I'm not confident to like place a huge amount of weight on explanations for how the Bible matches with things that are observed, witnesses. But this much I know, the flood, as a biblically attested event, is a catastrophe, and would caution me then to not extrapolate from the present to the past. Just as a side note, the flood, I am told from one of the theology journals I read a while back, is the most attested event outside of the Bible. It's a biblical event that has the most witnesses in other cultures. Say 65 cultures, I think it is, have a flood story. Okay, I hope you realize that when you look at the Bible, it would say use caution to extrapolate from the present into the past, and that opens up the possibility of other ways for explaining phenomena that we see today. How compatible is theistic evolution with, say, Christianity? If you look at just God using secondary causation, which is providence, it's very compatible. Providence is the idea of God sustaining and governing all that he has made. It's the idea that God is actively involved in his world, giving life. Even as Paul, quoting a Greek poet, said, in him we live and move and have our being, that God is the sole power of the universe and is supplying power to his creation, not being, like in pantheism, not being his creation, being separate from his creation, but upholding, sustaining, empowering, giving life, giving power to the world that he has made, as well as governing it. Or as Ecclesiastes says, there's an appointed time for everything, having ordained and appointed all that would occur. As we saw with Job, God didn't go down and give Job boils or kill his sons and his daughters. God appointed it. He let Satan do it. And then Satan even used fire and wind and the Sabians, the Chaldeans, stirring them up. There's layers of causation within the world, and God uses secondary causation a very traditional doctrine of providence, and I believe that theoretically theistic evolution would be compatible with providence. Doesn't necessarily mean that's what happened, but on a theoretical level, I think it is compatible. Now, when we look at some books of the Bible, if we look at Job, what we learn there is that God affirms science, but then cautions us on about the fallibility of science. Science itself teaches us that man's knowledge is limited. The world is weird. Strange things are out there that we don't know. Things are out there that we can't do. We have limits with regard to our science and technology, and science itself says it. Even Thomas Kuhn, right, with the paradigm shifts that, you know, are famously seen in physics, from Ptolemaic, you know, geocentric universe or views of the solar system to, you know, heliocentric, Copernican, Galileo views of the solar system, you know, Newtonian physics, then to Einstein and the three groundbreaking articles in 1905, and how we have, you know, quantum mechanics and general and special relativity. Those large shifts in which the model changed and it absorbed the good things from the past and expanded. Why would we not expect that process to continue? I've often thought, why would I not expect the Darwinian evolutionary theory of the 1800s to go by the wayside like other theories from the 1800s have, like ether? You know, things like that. Why would I not expect that also to shift and change to something else in the future that accounts for the data and is a model to be used with explanatory power and the ability to give research projects? Well, Ecclesiastes tells us also that nature appears to be cyclical, not directional. This is attested both in the East, the religions of the East and their cyclical view of the world, even taking it to extreme like reincarnation, but also in the West and the Greeks having a view of the world of the pendulum going back and forth, you might say, with everything's periodic or cyclical. Ecclesiastes says that if you're just looking at the world by observation, no revelation, no cheating going on, God not whispering into your anything, just observing. Mere empiricism. What you would draw away with is not a progressive linear kind of change in the world. It would be cyclical. Now, that questions the whole, you know, assumption of progress. It was the 19th century confidence in progress, according to Peter Bowler's book on evolution, The History of an Idea, the 19th century's confidence in progress and incline them to believe evolution. Now today, instead of a tree of life and a more hierarchical view of evolution, Bowler says there's more of a bush. It can just go in a various directions. And in that sense, I suppose you could make it compatible with the cyclical nature of other natural processes. Generations come, generations go. Species come, species go. I could see that that could be fitted, pardon the pun, but fitted as well to that view. But let there not be a sense of natural progress in the world. But here's the objection or the stumbling block or obstacle that is a make or break one with me. When I first heard it, it was like a mammoth light went off. It's a theological argument, but it's biblical. It's also the one that a friend of mine who's a graduate of the college and has believed his views changed, I think, in college, and he adopted a theistic evolutionary position. But he told me, and I appreciated his candor with me, that this is the one big obstacle he has no answer for. Now, that doesn't mean he's not thinking about it, and I would expect as a thoughtful individual that he will, and maybe someday he'll have an answer that satisfies him. But for myself, to me, I've not found an answer to this, and so it hinders me and is an obstacle to theistic evolution, and here it is. In Romans chapter 5, Paul says that through one man, sin entered into the world. Now that's the account given in Genesis. And death entered the world through sin. In other words, death may appear to be normal because it happens all the time, but it is not natural. It was not originally in the world. It's God imposed it upon the world as a punishment due to a moral choice made by man. It was through sin, the choice of a man, that death entered into the world. I think the scope of it being the world implies that it's more than just humans that are dying. Some have responded to me, well, humans started dying then. That would then require a kind of like exception again to the rule that would demand an explanation, and the burden of proof would be there. I think it refers to all of creation, as Romans 8 says the curse has been imposed on all creation, and even Genesis, God cursed the ground, which indirectly brought man to death. But here's the point. If man is the cause of death, and yet man is the end point, or near the end of evolution, how can you account to all that trial and error, survival of the fittest going on for eons and eons and eons of time, which requires death, and the fossil record being then given as testimony to that fact? How can you account for all that death leading up to man if somehow man is the cause of death itself? And that's when death entered into the world. To me, that objection hinders me from believing in theistic evolution, and also changes the way that I view death. No longer do I view it as a friend, in other words, as something that might help us to weed out the weak and to promote the strong. I view death then as an enemy, which is the way the Bible describes it in 1 Corinthians 15, that it is the last enemy. Something to be destroyed and removed from the world, it is not our friend. Of course, as a pastor, I've officiated at funerals, and I've seen the grief. This should not be. It's not right. The feelings that the grief, the crying out when the casket is closed and the body is put in the ground, and those moments where it's like something's wrong with the world. On the one hand, yes, it's normal and we should expect it, we should plan for it. But as Ecclesiastes says, it takes the meaning out of everything we do. There's got to be a resurrection. Otherwise, what's the point? Now I'm happy that we're going to be able to look at that, the Bible's testimony to the answer that God provided in the resurrection. And I'm thankful to have a revelation, or I would not know about these things. And so when you bring revelation and resurrection, the two fundamental needs of mankind, into the picture, things change. But if I look just empirically at the world and then think like a Christian, these two things are not compatible. If man brought death, then how can man be the endpoint, or the recent endpoint, of an evolutionary development? Okay, well, I hope this is helpful. Your reading for next time is a little debate in the early 90s, and it's just a sampling of how the intelligent design movement has been criticized or engaged with the larger scientific community. It is another way of looking at this issue. Some of those in the intelligent design movement, maybe not many, but I think one of their founders still holds to an evolutionary model, but it's not Darwinian. Most of them are not going to be evolutionists, and there's a kind of a theistic feel to the group because they're claiming there's an intelligence that has designed animals. And so I'm going to have you read some of their literature. Jonathan Wells is in that group. You've read him already. He's going to talk about some sloppiness in some textbooks. And it's going to help us to see academics are still humans. And so I'm sure some of those things have been addressed. I would think they've been addressed in some of those textbooks by now. You also have an article by Stephen Jay Gould. I mentioned him earlier with the punctuated equilibrium. He's going to be giving a response to Philip Johnson, who used his work a lot to discredit evolution. And so you're going to be able to read firsthand how this Harvard paleontologist responded publicly. You're also going to read Philip Johnson's response to Stephen Jay Gould. And then finally, Michael Ruess is a philosopher of science. He's still alive as far as I know. I just saw a book published by him in his 80s, a little review on it. And he's going to respond to the kind of epiphany he received in doing some interaction with Philip Johnson and those in the intelligent design movement. Kind of a personal awareness of just kind of his own assumptions in doing his philosophy. So I hope those readings, read them in the order that you see them in the syllabus. I hope you'll enjoy them, and let's talk about them when you return. Thank you.